Today's sponsor is Home Theater Solutions. Absolutely love these guys. HTS is your local technology expert, serving Delaware for 16 years. Home Theater Solutions specializes in TV installations, home automations, Sonos audio systems, security cameras, and Wi-Fi networks. For all of your home and business tech needs, give them a call, 1-800-690-2029, or visit htsav.net. All right, welcome back. This is the Rehoboth Social Podcast, part of the Social Podcast Network, www.socialpodcastnetwork.com. Local folks doing local podcasts.
May 11th.
Yeah, May 11th. I don't know. Do we have any local folks doing local podcasts still? Or is it just me? No, I guess Tiff.
Yeah, you, the network.
The network.
The Social Podcast Network.
I had this whole dilemma the other day. Should I say www? I'm like, socialpodcast.com, and I was like, it's crazy. Good morning. How are you, buddy?
I'm great. How are you?
So I've been looking forward to this. We've been going back and forth a little bit, trying to reach out, trying to connect and find a date and a time that would both work for us, and we have finally done it. So I just want to say thank you.
I'm so stoked to be here. Yeah, life's busy. It's crazy, but super happy to be here.
Yeah, so Hari Cameron.
Yeah.
From Grandpa Max. What else have you done? Because I know you've done others.
Yeah, so right before the pandemic, I owned a fine dining restaurant for 8 years, and it was great. It was like my dream restaurant. I opened it when I was 29 years old. I had a 10-year dream to open it before I was 30.
Are you going to say the name?
It was a Muse restaurant.
A Muse. That was
Beach.
It. Yep.
Yeah. And that was, it was awesome. You know, we did tasting menus there, and we, you know, get happy hour. We could do all kinds of great things. It was really exploring food and a great time in my life. And I was that type of hands-on fine dining chef for 20 years. And the opportunity to divest from it presented itself, and we took it. And it was perfect timing. Like, pandemic conditions were not ideal for fine dining. So
what was your muse?
So a muse, people always say, like, is it a muse? Is it a muse? Is it? But we wanted food to be fun and musing. We wanted to think about food and be inspired, which was the muse.
Yeah.
In French cooking, there's that little bite that you get before the meal starts, which is the amuse-bouche, amuse-guille. So the amuse is that bite that makes you happy. So that's what we wanted. When we first opened the restaurant, we had 5 sections of small plates, and each dish had a different weird esoteric kind of inspiration behind the dish. And quickly we're like, yeah, we're not in a city. People here on vacation, they want traditional app entree. But then we offered the tasting menu, which was cool. So each dish was inspired. My inspiration came from the things we were out looking for in the wild, foraging, or the things that the farmers were bringing in, or the seasons. Those would all be inspirations behind the dishes.
Yeah.
So, you know, I like to explore technique. I love, but it was a great restaurant. It did what it had to do. It was successful by all means, but having a new young baby and another boy and Grandpa Mac, and I'm doing so many things now that it was a good time for me to be, you know, move on from that.
Freed you up a little bit.
For sure.
Well, and I think we do things for a while, and I think it creates more avenues and more openings of thought and ideas. And maybe, you know, we just did a podcast with another guy, and we were talking about how, you know, we get so consumed with what we have, and it almost puts us in this sort of like prison of fear, like, oh my God, what happens if I lost this? We'd never succeed. You know, I don't know. Were you friends with Matt?
I was, yeah.
So Matt used to always say, hey, man, as long as you're not smoking crack and paying for hookers, bro, it'll all work out. And I was like, hey, thanks, Matt. You really simplified that for me, but good point.
You know, it's for restaurant work, it is such a commitment. And I loved it. You know, I loved nights and weekends. I love the things I miss about having that restaurant are like seeing the guests that I saw every day. I really had some really great connections with people that I, you know, then the pandemic happened, then I really wasn't hanging out with them. But then also, like, working with a team is awesome. When you have, like, I didn't have high turnover. I had a crew of people that were my family, and I got to see them every day and hang out and create beautiful things. And, you know, missing that type of pirate ship camaraderie is a thing as well. So, and then talking to the farmers, you know, like, I had so many farmers that would be like, hey, what can you do with this thing? They come to the back door and bring me, you know, bring me those beautiful things, and like touching those things all the time. It
roots.
Made me happy. Yeah. Oh,
roots.
Everything, you know, like fresh soft shell crab and like all kinds of beautiful vegetables. And, you know, those are the things that made me happy. But
well, that was definitely trending early prior. And it's almost like we're in two worlds now, right? It's like pre, and it's like not much has changed. I mean, of course, we went through like the craziest couple years, right? Who knew where we would be when it all kind of finally settled out? But here we are, kind of, I'm in the same place I was prior, but it seems like this two different worlds of thought. And, you know, prior to pandemic was a lot of farm to table, you know, a lot. And we definitely live in a great area for that. You know, I don't know for what sure. that's like, you know, having a restaurant like downtown New York City. But out here, you go two blocks over and you literally have farm fields. So I can totally imagine, you know, who do we have? The guy from Coastal One.
Matt Kern.
He was on.
Yeah. Great guy.
And he was working with Helen Riley over at, is it Strawberry Hill Farms? But they're teaming up and they're doing these same kind of things. I think that's pretty awesome when you have that to kind of
for sure
fall back on, right?
There's like a rule. It's not even falling back. It's like there's a rule of cooking, and it's like you can't get great things if you're not using. It's life as well. It's like you get out what you put in, and if you're already using really beautiful, fresh, great things, it's like, what do I have to do not to mess this up? Just keep it simple, make it beautiful. So if you're using really great things going in, it's a lot easier to, you know, you can't make really great things if you're not using great ingredients.
Exactly.
And it's like life. If you put really good things in, you'll get really good things out of it.
So, yeah, and I think that actually kind of represents how we are in our lives as well. You know, if we're not really in a good space, you know, maybe just our vibes, you know, can struggle as well. So
for sure.
Absolutely. I'm a huge fan of food. You know, clearly we eat it, so I love that part of it. But I just love, you know, the art. And it's almost like a team, right? You know, you're almost like the quarterback, and the success of the night is to make the quarterback shine. And that's, I love that when it.
Yeah, I love how food, from a young age, I really realized that food is so much more than just the mindlessly putting things in our body. It's like, it is culture. It is things where it's an intimate experience. And you're going out with somebody and you're sharing a part of your life, but you're physically putting things into your mouth. And it's like, you're sharing a time and a space. And, you know, food can be so many things, you know, but that's why I love Grandpa Mac as well. You know, Grandpa Mac is this business where you can go in and you can get a panini or a soup or a salad or freshly made pasta that won't break the bank. And you can get it, you know, like having young kids with our society now. During the pandemic, having Grandpa Mac was, I mean, my little brother came to me with the idea. He was in California. He said, hey.
And is that the brother I met?
Orion.
Yeah, I met him the other day at Shall We Bounce.
Yeah.
He's like, Harry's my brother. I'm like, yeah, come on the podcast with us. He's all, no, Harry's the talker. I'm not the talker.
He's really good. He is a hospitality guy. Like, you'll see him there, and friendliest person and super creative as well. And yeah, you'll have him on at another time.
And people in the hospitality business understand hospitality.
It's like the
hair business.
For sure. It's forward facing. It's people, you know, it's like the chefs that are toiling away, just like yelling and throwing pans. And that stereotype is long gone. You can't be, you have to be, because who wants to work there for that? Those type of people, you know,
but we're too sensitive.
You should treat people. If you want it to be a profession, you should treat people professionally.
Yeah.
And, yeah, but so for Grandpa Mac, we...
can I just say one thing also that I love about the restaurant business is that you see a lot of guys that kind of come up through like dishwashing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, all the steps. You don't see that a lot in a lot of businesses. You kind of start, you know, whatever you're doing, and you start where you're at, and that's kind of where you're at. And you don't see the struggles that go on below you or that go on above you. And one of the things about working in the kitchen is, especially if you want to work for like a great chef, the first thing they put you in is washing dishes. And they want you to know, these are the dishes that you're sending to the dishwashers. Could you clean them up better? You know, understand what you're putting other people through. And I think it's a great way to kind of come up through a business.
Yeah, I think restaurants are great. It's a great trade. It's a great art. It definitely is something where my whole life, even in high school, I was working in restaurants. You know, my mom had us when she was young, and she works for BB now. She's a physical therapist assistant, but she was a server, a waitress, and to see what she did, we were always super interested. We lived in different places, but we'd go help her bust the tables even when we were kids. And Yeah, I love the trade of it. I mean, I've worked every position in a restaurant over so many years.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I've worked as a chef, as cooking professionally for 20 years, and it was not 20 years of 9 to 5. It was like long. It was like two lifetimes, you know, it was
right.
Like long hours, many weekends, 6-day weeks, you know, summertime, jamming hot kitchens, putting out lots of plates. Definitely, I actually like washing dishes now. You get to sit there and just like zone in on the chill. Dishes and kind of like scrub, but like work organized, like keep grinding it down. Yeah, I really like being a server. Like at one point, as a kid, or you know, maybe like a young man, I was a server at Bob Evans, and I had to bus my butt for like change. You know, these people are like giving me, oh, here's a dollar, here, son, here's a dollar. But it was amazing. I was like, I like the work. I've always loved people. I like the fast pace. You know, I first went to school for business and communications at Dell Tech, and after like 2 semesters, I didn't have the discipline. It wasn't the right time for me to be in there doing it.
Yeah.
And so I kept working in restaurants, and the more I did it, the more I loved it. And one time they said, hey, Hari, can the salad person sick? Like, can you make salads? This was at the Buttery in Lewis when it was there. And I said, yeah, I can make salads. It was for Gary Papp and Lorraine. They're awesome people at Harbor. You can go visit them now. But
are they the ones that had Palette?
They did have Palette, yep.
Yep.
Palette as well. But they said, can you make these salads? And I said, yeah, I can make them. And like, I was the weird kid that was like out picking sassafras and beating my brother with it and organizing my Skittles and artistic patterns and like playing with my food. So to me, it was super fun. You know, I'd worked in restaurants before that, but it wasn't something that I saw myself doing or took serious. But when I was learning, and it was like, I was at the right point in my life of learning. And like, I think it's like the restaurant business is great if you have great mentors.
Sure.
You know, because there's a lot of people that, you know, restaurant, it's not a super glamorous thing to do. You know, it's like hard to get, but the people that do it and like love doing it are dedicated. And like, I think picking where you work and the people you work around is super important. If you're not in the right environment, it's futile. You might as well just go dig ditches or something.
And
you know?
The restaurant like, business has seen it all, right? So, I mean, I remember Matt saying that, you know, it was the business that it would accept me, you know, and when he'd come, he kind of came out of his thing. And when he finally decided to, you know, find it to a place in his life where he was ready to start finding some humility, I suppose we could say. Mm-hmm. He's like, the restaurant business was the one that accepted me and took me in and loved me and cared for me until I could finally care for myself, right?
For sure. For sure. If you work hard, the sky's the limit. You Absolutely. Can do, and like Matt is a shining example of that and everything he created. When we opened Nage, this was in like 2005, it was where Fork and Flask was.
That's the one that I was thinking. I knew Amuse, but I knew Nage, and I got confused in the changes of the names.
So I was a sous chef, a young cook under Kevin Reading at Nage, and it was an open kitchen. It was like one building, and Matt would come. Our friendship started as he would come and just plop down while we were cooking at the open kitchen and sit there. It wasn't really a table anybody else sat at, but it was great to see him and talk to him and serve him things. Like, hey, what are you doing there? And it was you know, did a lot of nonprofit things with him.
Sure.
And, you know, he was a fiery person. We always had good times and good conversations. I'm like, intense, but in all the good ways, for sure.
Well, and that's the kind of business where, you know, I remember a long time ago when I first opened the spot, and there was a place down here. I'm not even going to say the name, but it was a it was a bakery. And Matt came down here, and I go, you want to go check out the bakery? He's like, oh, yeah, let's go check it out. So we walked down. He's like, hey, can I come back and take a look at your kitchen? You know, that's what chefs do, right?
Absolutely.
He's like, no. and Matt was like, oh, all right, you know. And then we walked out. He's like, that's a shame. I might have even put his scones in my restaurants. Yeah. And he's like, he'll never make it. And they didn't. You know, there's an openness, I think, that takes place among chefs that, you know, always supporting. You know, Matt was always about, you know, cooperation over competition. You know, how can I help? You know, he would tell me stories of restaurants calling in the middle of the night, our power's out or our water's out. And then Matt would show up with like 6 people and be like, how can we help? You know, that was.
Yeah, it's definitely a really, especially in this area, such a good community, a tight-knit community. Like, I know, you know, I was at a hospitality party last night, and seeing people, I'm always like, yeah, call me if you need anything. And definitely, you never know, you know, it's like your next-door neighbor. It's like, borrow a box of soda or some seafold towels or, you right. know, all of these things, or, you know, yeah, water goes out, or all of these things that happen. So
yeah, you don't say, oh, sorry about your luck. You say, sure. What can we do?
So where, again, going where Grandpa Mac is now, Taco Rio is right next to us, the yep. new Taco Rio. Arena is just open right next to us as well. And, like, you know, I think in some areas and some businesses, like, oh, that's the competition. But we don't feel that way at all. No. We're super stoked to have such good neighbors, you know, Stick. All those guys at Arenas are great guys. It's like, gives us another place to go. It brings energy into our shopping center. It's like, they come over there, we go over there. It's a great thing. And that's like how the restaurant community is. It's like, there's a million places to go eat. You know, the cream will rise to the top. People will pick their favorite places. Yeah. You can go a lot of places for meals. On Route 1, how many restaurants are there? So many restaurants. But it's all good. You know, we want everybody to, there's enough people here that everybody can get a piece of it. And it's, you know.
Well, and the cool thing is that at some point, somebody's, you know, if the new arena's open, they may have worked at Grandpa Mac's at one point, or they may have been making sure. some shells for Billy over at Taco Rio. So
for sure.
It's a family yeah. behind open doors, so to speak. Yeah. And
there's definitely some guys that work, shout out to Billy, that worked for us at Grandpa Mac that now work at Taco Rio. And it's great. You know, people, in this life, you have to work, and you have to find your crew and be happy. And they still are. They're still family. They come by, absolutely. Come to the back door and say hi. And it's a great thing for sure.
Well, my mom loved Grandpa Mac. I mean, she's passed, but she used to say, can you just bring me some Grandpa Mac? I'd sneak her Grandpa Mac into BB. I'd be awesome. Like, nothing to see here. And she'd be, oh, I love Grandpa Mac. But I do think it's important, because I think if people didn't know, they would think it was just macaroni and cheese over there. And you guys are doing a lot of cool stuff. I don't know what your menu looked like when you opened and what is compared to as it looks today. So maybe we can talk about that and yes. all the great stuff that's going on over there.
So when we opened downtown, we opened in a small space. It was like the old Touch of Italy space.
And yeah.
It was a small footprint, but it was really just to test the concepts, to see if people liked it, to see if it worked. And we had that space for 5 years. And yeah, Orion came to me and said, Hari, mac and cheese, what are your thoughts? What do you think? And I'm like, hey, it can be kind of heavy. I'm not a boxed pasta kind of guy. So let's think about it. And I said, well, if we can make everything from scratch, if we can keep it affordable, if we can, you know, I'm doing fine dining now. If it can be something different, if it can be how people want to eat and how people need to eat. So we looked into it, and the first thing we invested in was a pasta extruder. It's a beautiful piece of machinery. You know, you put semolina flour in, you add water, we hydrate the flour, it mixes it, and the auger pushes it against the die plate, and it pushes different shapes of pasta, extrudes pasta. And the great thing about fresh pasta is the flavor is really great, the texture is good, but it cooks in 2 minutes. You know, it cooks in a minute and a half, depending on the type of noodle that you're getting. And it has, you know, just this beautiful texture. Also, cooking it so fast, you know, you're preserving the nutrition. You're not boiling sure. all the nutrition into the water. And then we can easily sauce it up. So, yeah, we opened up with our same pastas that we have now. We had a couple salads then. But in that space, it was like cooking in a submarine. It was like our food truck, you know. It's like
right.
you can only do so much in the space that you have efficiently. So when we went to our larger space on Route 1, we put panini sandwiches on, which are some really great ones, like the meatball panini, the mushroom. We'd actually do that mac and cheese panini, which has a strip of mac and cheese and more cheese and melting. Oh, and it's like carb on carb, love madness. You know, it's a good one. But we do a wonderful tomato soup, which is, it's like super creamy and delicious, but it's vegan. It's like, and not even, it just doesn't need butter. You know, it's like, it has like onions and carrots and pureed and creamy and nice. And at Grandpa Mac, we really try to, again, right, costs are rising everywhere, you know, but we really try to be affordable for the quality that we're giving. And the other thing is, we try to have something for as many people as possible. Like, all of our dishes, you can get made gluten-free. It's like, only 10% of society eats gluten-free, maybe even a smaller percentage needs to eat gluten-free. But, you know, when you make that one person happy who really is a celiac that can't eat gluten, they tell 10 of their friends. Like, you make them happy. Or if you make a vegan super stoked, they're bringing their non-vegan friends. Yeah. And it's really about caring for people as well. And, like, I think it's important to, like, meet people where they are. And, like, so we made, like, our meatballs gluten-free. Our mac and cheese sauce, gluten-free. You know, usually people use the roux,
yep,
butter, flour, add the cream. For us, we use something called sour salt, sodium citrate, which allows all the cheeses to perfectly melt. Oh. So we can use 7 beautiful, nice cheeses and make them into the perfect Velveeta-y texture sauce, which is nice.
How do you – because gluten-free is it's serious.
It is.
It's a, you know, people are like, oh, I think I might have gluten intolerant. If you have celiac, it's a life-changing event. And yeah. My father-in-law, or my ex-father-in-law, I should say, great guy though, had celiac. And he couldn't have the dust on a piece of gum, which is a flour-based gluten product that keeps it from sticking to the paper. Yeah. He couldn't even eat that. I mean, back 12 years ago, the gluten-free game was pretty much limited to Cracker Barrel, for him at least. I mean, he could go in there, he could say, listen, I have celiac, he had a card. They would cook everything for him on tinfoil. You cannot cook things on the same grill.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you know all this, but it's...
For sure.
When you start to swing that gluten-free flag, you have got...
Yeah. There's a lot tricky. Of pizza restaurants that cook gluten-free pizza, but in their decks and the ovens, you can't get that flour out of there.
No.
So people that are intolerant, they can do that, but gluten-free, you can't eat that same...
Nope.
So for us, we blend all of our starches, all the rice flours and all the flours to make the gluten-free pasta. We make the gluten-free pasta in a separate area in our back kitchen.
Yeah.
Because it can't even be close to all the flour. Nope. Where the flour is served. We extrude it from a smaller pasta machine that's never seen gluten. So it's not like we're changing over the flour to gluten-free. And then where the pasta's cooked is up away from the other pasta cookers in a separate area that's just a gluten-free cooker. And then we're really mindful with, you know, again, we want to, you know, the first rule of cooking is do no harm. We want to keep people happy and healthy coming back.
It's a good rule.
Know? Yeah. I think that's medicine. But yeah. Hey, cooking, medicine, same thing. You know.
Same thing in the hair business.
Yeah.
No, do no harm.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, scissors, knives, scissors, food. You don't want to hurt anybody.
It's our philosophy here at the Rehoboth Social Podcast. We're not here to hurt anybody. We're here to promote.
That's perfect. Yeah, so I think that being mindful of where people are, being mindful of, you know, we change over our gloves every time, especially being very mindful of gluten-free things. We cook everything in a separate area. Again, eating is dangerous. It can be dangerous. You know, sure. People, you know, you eat an oyster, there's a risk involved in that. Or you eat a medium rare steak, not well done. It's a very, very small risk.
Wait a minute, what?
Well, there's, I mean.
We're at risk here.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying inherently, so we do everything in our power to keep people safe. We really do. We take the precautions. But if you know, I've heard allergies, like people on an airplane where somebody was eating peanuts got sick, you know, like it was in the air next to somebody. Like if you're that
sensitive,
then cook for yourself, probably.
Right. Well, don't test me, right? Because I don't need that.
We cook for celiac people all the time, and we're really good about it. Again, people need to understand where they are and the risk involved.
Well, in the celiac game, you know, preparing food for people that do have that issue has come a long way. And I think that was the point of me bringing that up. Yeah. Like, it was – people don't understand. Now, listen, if I'm going to have – you know, and I think also the – not quality, but how much you can enjoy gluten-free. Gluten-free food it wasn't always a winner-winner gluten-free dinner. I mean, it's come a long way. I think
for sure. There's so many great, I mean, I say great, like I just did an event where I cooked food for the Milton Theater recently, and I did a bunch of hors d'oeuvres, and you know, the gluten-free bread has gotten a lot better. I made some gluten-free toast. There's a lot of gluten-free products, like that I actually have done a bunch of R&D for a bunch of businesses as well. Like that's part of my job now is consulting. And when I consult, I do product, you know, I do work with advocacy groups that promote things. I work with equipment companies. I do R&D on products, which are like taking somebody's product and bringing it, helping them bring it to market, doing the science kind of R&D stuff on that. But I've definitely worked on some keto and some gluten-free pastas in the past to help people. And it's amazing. It's amazing the things that you can do. But yeah, xanthan gum is like a main gluten replacer, but there's a lot of things that you can use, just such a small amount of it. And they really work to replace the gluten to give you some of the structure that's needed, you know? And again, like...
Well, and I think gluten gives you the elasticity, right?
It does. Some springy, spongy. Protein. Yeah. I've had some gluten-free pizzas, which were pretty good. Pizza's probably one of the harder ones to do. Breads, pastas, you know. Sometimes, you know, I'm a flour and water kind of guy. I love making the things from scratch, but I think there's some pretty good...
Well, and what I was going to say was, listen, if I, you know, if I'm going to have a big bowl of macaroni and cheese and there's a decent gluten-free version of it, I may do that. And I don't have celiac, but I do feel the, you know, when you eat a lot of bread and gluten, I mean, gluten is really not good for all of us. Some of us just tolerate it better.
For sure. So,
ask a guy with celiac, like my father-in-law, he's like, you're an idiot for ever eating flour. And he's like, Jesus, all right, I'm sorry, you know, but you know, they're very passionate.
Yeah, I think that the gluten itself generally isn't the problem. I think it's the carb load.
Quantity?
I think it's just like those carbohydrates, those starches just quickly turn to sugars. The thing about most gluten-free pasta still has a lot of carbs, so people have this perception in their mind like, oh, it's going to be so much healthier. Well, it might be healthier. You know, sometimes they say that wheat can make people – have puffy responses and these different things. But I think that, eat to make you happy. If you know gluten's not jiving with you, do the gluten-free, you know?
Well, and it's like, nice that we have better options these days, you know?
For sure.
Yeah, my point was back then, you know,
yeah,
you got pizza on a Tostito.
Yeah.
Because that was corn.
Yep, pizza rolls.
Yeah, pizza rolls. After school. Right, exactly. No, I think that's great. I you know, I think it's important that, you know, it's great to hear the hard work that you put in to make sure that that's safe, because it is, you know, it's not, you know, I'm gluten-free this week and I'm not next week. You know, it's a lifestyle. And I remember also my father-in-law, this was really before celiac kind of was so popular, or not popular, but...
Present,
thank you. Mm-hmm. And he had to do a lot of research prior to that. He was diagnosed with all these different diseases, and it turns out he just can't eat gluten.
Yeah, my mom recently is like, Hari, I'm cutting out the gluten. I'm cutting out the wheat and stuff. I'm like, Mom, like, what's up? Are you all right? You know, like, you're not going to drink a beer? Like, well, she's like, hey, it's like some skin thing. It's like, it's like clearing up some dry skin or something. I was like, hey, if it makes you happy, if you can do it. And, you know, I guess it's like, it's good when you aren't celiac, where if you like do cheat and have a piece of pizza or something like that, it's not going to kill you. You know, like if you're, I have a friend. Okay. This is a crazy one. He got bit by a tick.
Oh geez.
And got a form of Lyme's disease where he can't eat any mammals except for humans and monkeys. No, that's a joke. He can't eat humans or monkeys. No.
That's the Lone Star tick.
Yeah, he's got alpha gal, you know, like this type of Lyme's disease where it was this one time where he was eating, he went to a Chinese food restaurant. What he thought was a chicken skewer was really pork, and it like dropped his blood pressure and it really messed him up. It's like, allergies are such a crazy thing.
They are.
You know, like, oh, I would hate to... That tick. I mean, I never was a big steak eater anyway. He eat mostly fish and duck and other things anyway. But, you know, that would be.
That'd be tough.
I had one of those ticks. So I looked into that. And if you ever have one, they got a white dot on their back, hence the Lone Star name.
Yeah.
And the thing with that is it takes like 6 hours to 48 hours for it to develop in your blood. So if you catch it within that window, you're good. But after that, you run a chance of developing a red meat allergy for the rest of your life.
It'd be crazy.
Which for most people, I think would be tragic, you know? Like, I know if I got that, I would...
It would just, it'd make everything harder, you know? Yeah. And he grows older, he's getting even more sensitive. I think, like, before he could have, like, meat stock or something, and now he's like, yeah, I can't even do any of it now. It, like, totally messes him up. And I'm like, Jesus, like, just think, like... Everything changed, you know. Things do change, you know. So,
well, and the other fun thing about which in your business is that everybody's a food connoisseur. We've been watching Julia on HBO Max. Have you seen any of
that? Julia Child? No, I actually haven't caught that one yet.
It's very good. Whoever the lady that plays her is, she nails it. But it's funny because it was a real transition at that time. I guess this is in the 40s and 50s, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
But 50s, they were, 60s, you know, trying to figure out how to film someone cooking. Yeah. And then this whole thing, like these people would show up and they want to get their cookbook signed. And she's like, well, tell me some of the recipes that you've tried at your home. And they're like, oh, we don't cook. We just watch you.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, nice. Yeah. And it's, but it is fun. We do the same thing. We love the cooking shows. And then you kind of... You know, all of a sudden you're like expert, right? And then
Julia Child is, you know, I loved all of her old school recipes. Like, I read the books for the recipes, and, you know, she was super ahead of her time, super, like, what she cooked was awesome, and, like, her life, very, very interesting story. Like, I've read extensively about her, like, at one point she was a spy. She, like, she lived, like, she did crazy things in her life, and, like, she... made her show happen. Like, that's like, talk about having a dream, and like, they're like, no, we're not going to put you on. We're not going to put you on. And she said, what's it going to take for me to get this show to happen? Like, the money, no problem. I'll get the money, I'll raise it, make it happen. And like, you know, I think that, like, yeah, there was no cooks on TV. It wasn't a thing. Well, and you know,
the whole business really was a lot of innovation just out of her show. You know, that I think she was on PBS, right? She was on public television, and then you watch how they started to try to innovate different ways. You know, they were the ones that came up with the big mirror above the cooking table. You know, so that they could see down. They had created all these different ways of holding cameras to try to. They wanted her to whip a meringue, right? And they wanted to film it. And it was very challenging to get these cameras. And so they created the mirror. But then all of a sudden they started selling the show to different, I think they sold it to San Francisco. I mean, a whole lot of stuff came out of just that one show.
For sure. I was one time in Atlantic City, okay? And we were at the Bobby Flay Steakhouse. And as a young cook, I was not the boy meets grill kind of guy. I wasn't the grilling and chilling guy, but I went up to Bobby Flay and I shook his hand and I really thanked him for what he has helped to do for food in our society. Yeah. You know, it's like putting it in front of people, getting people interested in it. I think not everything about food TV I love. It's definitely, but some of the things I do love about it is it really has put it to the forefront, you know, like made people care about chefs and the food that they're cooking and like what I think everybody needs to know. You know, people ask me like, hey, Hari, do you want your sons to be a chef? And I'm like, well, I want my sons to be happy in whatever job they do, whatever they take. Everybody needs to eat. Everybody needs to cook for somebody at some point. Everybody needs to care for people. So I want my sons to have respect for the people preparing their food. I want them to know what they're putting in their body, know how to cook something good to feed themselves or the people they love. But other than that, that's their job and relationship. I just want them to be happy, but they're definitely going to, you know, but both my sons are great eaters. It's amazing. I'm blessed in that way. Like they both, you know, the 2-year-old and the 6-year-old are like, let's get some more sushi, the sushi. I'm like, and
they like the expensive stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I grew up, I mean, I'm 53, I guess, and so I grew up in a time where my mom, you know, there was a middle class, right? We were the middle class, and we cooked every night, and it went from, like, pork chops to spaghetti to pan-fried spaghetti to salmon patties to this whole array of different things. We never ate out. I mean, maybe. It wasn't a great time for chefs back then. I mean, you know, there was some restaurants, but not like today.
Oh, in the 70s and 80s, chefs was like the doldrums. You're cooking in dungeons. It was like hot and grimy places. Like the stories that, you know, I kind of cook in the late 90s and 2000s, which were, you know, bringing a light on things and kind of changing the culture a lot.
Bringing the chef up out of the basement.
For sure, for sure. Yeah. So my name is Hari. My dad was a hippie and, like, of that generation. And some of my earliest childhood memories were vegetarian and vegan Indian curries. So when I eat these Indian curries, it really brings me, like, to, like, a weird place of home for a 30, 40-year-old white guy, you know what I mean? But for me, I lived in New York for a while. I can remember eating weird foods as a kid. One time as a little kid, I can remember being in D.C. and eating at an Ethiopian restaurant. And, like,
wow.
I can remember sitting on the floor with the mats and I remember them bringing out the flat bread, the injera, and, like, dumping the different dura wat and the different – and, like, I was like, huh, that's a weird place for an egg or some bones or, like, some – but, those are the times that I was really – as a kid, exploring food, and I always were asking the questions like, huh, this is an interesting thing to eat, and that's why I like the cultural elements of it. And I've always explored food. I think it's a cool thing.
Well, and to finish a little bit of the thing where I was leading was that I basically cook like my mom now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's mm-hmm. she taught me. She never taught me anything, but I watched, right? And you know, I've taken all that I learned. I mean, I love to cook I prefer to cook for my family. I mean, I make lunches, I make breakfast. I mean,
what are your highlights? Like, what are the good things that you cook? What are your specialties?
Our favorite thing is flat iron steak, which is this freaking secret. Nobody seems to know about it. It's catching on because pre-pandemic, I could get flat iron steak for about $10, mm-hmm. and now it's about $21. So it's the same thing as skirt. Skirt used to be, nobody ate skirt steak. And then they started marinating, making carne asada. And now, I mean, skirt steak is so expensive.
I think that it's a twofold problem. I think that, yes, it's catching on, but, like, supply chain issues, like when people were getting sick in the pandemic, there weren't enough people to cut meat. And, you know, like, there's not enough drivers driving things. Like, sure. It's another conversation. The full thing of, like, all of the real costs that takes a raw product and actually gets it to your plate is crazy.
Yeah, no, and the one bad thing that flat iron steak has going for it, it has a silver skin sort mm-hmm. of that kind of runs through one half of it, kind of down the middle. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, you can take it out. I don't. I eat it. It's not a big deal. But, you know, I mm-hmm. think some people be like, oh, silver skin, you know, like it's not a filet mignon.
It's easy enough to eat around if you don't like it. You could tenderize it in other ways as well, or just eat it.
Flat iron steak is amazing.
Yeah,
and I just basically sear it in a, you know, I don't even have a grill. I got rid of it. I sear it in a cast iron skillet mm-hmm. in the oven for 8 minutes at 350. Comes out, it is perfect. And
I would rather eat a off cut, as they say, you know, like, than filet, because, like, I think flat iron has just a great flavor.
Oh,
you know,
it's flat iron is amazing.
Whenever you get a muscle group in a cow that's being worked more than, you know, the tenderloin or some of these primal cuts, right, it's going to have more blood flow go to it. Sometimes it'll have more silver skin, but often it'll have more marbling, more flavor because of, you know, where it is and where it is on the cow. So there's a lot of cuts. Like, have you ever had a hanger steak before?
I've had hanger steak.
Hanger steak's pretty good. It's off of the heart. I like that one. And then there's, like, Terrace Major. I mean, there's a lot of, like...
Well, I think, you know, and there's... I mean, YouTube is... I watch a lot of different things on YouTube, and
I went to YouTube University as well, so...
I love it, yeah.
For a lot of things, yeah.
And is it the Bearded Butchers?
I've seen those guys, yeah.
Those guys, I mean, and you know, they're... You can tell that industry is still growing. I mean, they're still learning. I mean, obviously, we've been butchering for however many years, but I think, like, flat iron steak is a new kind of cut. It may have been cut a different way, but you to get a hanger or a flat iron steak, you kind of got to go digging around.
There's so many different schools of thought on butchery,
yeah,
and a lot of them are super regional. There's, like, Spanish ways to cut, and then they're both from Spain, but then also from South America, where they get certain cuts that we might not get. And it's just all that you're looking at the same muscle grouping, but how you cut it. And then the English, the French, Japanese butchery is different, Chinese butchery is different. So it's really like looking at what cuts you want and how you're going to prepare it from there. But I like a short rib a lot. Like, I'm a big fan of those tougher cuts that are really well marbled that you either have to braise or you could pressure cook them or sous vide cook them to get them really tender. But I like that marbling. Like, I like that flavor and how it eats. Like, I was cooking for a beautiful couple recently where I was doing a 5-course tasting for them, and they were getting married in a couple of days, but they wanted one really nice meal for that they were eating. And I found out that the wife was the fiance was expecting as well. So she said, I'd really like to have the meat well done. And I'm like, well, that's no problem. I can make delicious food and cook it every way. But I did. I cooked it super slow for 2 days then glazed it in this beautiful stock in a short rib. And it was just, it was beautiful. And I was like, yeah, I'm definitely, you know, I prefer my steak medium rare. But if you cook it well done, but you cook it slow and low with love, I think you can make beautiful things with
it. Well, and that was a learning. That was something I had to learn, is that I'm the guy that just throws it on the grill, you know, and flips it over and then serves it. And you kind of got what you got. And to learn, you know, about temperature, you know, a nice 125, 135 in the middle, that's a...
Yeah. Have you ever done any reverse searing?
So you mean bake it and then sear it at the end?
Yeah. So you cook it really low, like maybe 150, or you cook it to the temperature you want to cook it in the oven over the course of an hour or two.
Nice.
And then you bring it. So then you temp it at, say you want your steak medium rare, you maybe cook it to 130, you know, 125, 127. And then depending on the thickness of the steak. Sure. And what you're doing is you're slowly bringing it there so it has all that moisture and nice. And then you're just searing it to get that caramelization, the Maillard reaction that makes steak taste like steak.
Color is flavor.
Yeah. When you sear steak, you're actually changing 256 chemicals. You're changing the proteins. It's more than just caramelizing sugars. You're creating new flavor aromas and compounds. Like, you could take that same steak and drop it in some water or stock and poach it, it's not going to taste like steak.
Mm-mm.
We get those flavor compounds from deep like caramelization. Oh, yeah.
You don't sous-vide a steak.
No.
No.
Sous-vide?
Sous-vide.
So you can sous-vide a
steak. That's my, that's all my.
Yeah, yeah. So you can.
Different words I know in chef.
It's still sous-vide.
So you can sous-vide steak successfully. It's sometimes not done well. It depends on the cut, what's happening with it. I think that, I like sous vide steak better than I like sous vide chicken. Like, I'd rather just roast or sear a piece of chicken. I think sous vide chicken sometimes comes out like flabby and weird textured. But like, you could sous vide a steak, but as long as you're cooking it low and slow and then giving it a nice sear for that caramelization, depending on what size the steak. And when you sear it, you're putting in a hot cast iron skillet,
yep,
a little bit of oil to start, salt, pepper.
The bottom shiny.
Are you pre-seasoning your steak at all? Like, sometimes it's good to take your steaks, season them 30 minutes before, and then sear them so that seasoning really gets in there.
Well, if we refer back to YouTube University, I did watch a guy who put salt on 24 hours, 12 hours, and then right before.
Oh, that's a lot. Hopefully he's only...
No, he did three different steaks. He put one on like a day before.
Nice.
And then one he had, one of the steaks just was 12. Mm-hmm. And then one he salted right before.
Beautiful.
And cooked them all. And he found, I think, the one that...
He liked best, which one?
I think it was like 12 hours. But I'm not sure there was a big difference.
Yeah.
But the meat looks a lot different after it's sat with salt on it for 12 hours.
I like when you add the salt and it gets in there. Like, people... You can never unsalt things. People are like, so don't oversalt anything. You know, people's salt tolerances are all different. But when you season something well, it actually helps your tongue find balance. So you can taste the flavors more. You know, everything needs to be seasoned, but you just have to be careful with your seasoning. So then you're heating up your cast iron skillet, getting it really nice and hot. Then do you add any, after you get that good sear, a little bit of butter in there? Butter, some
aromatics,
garlic, look at me, a little bit of thyme.
I'm talking chef talk right here. Aromatics, you mean?
Are you adding some aromatic? Are you doing some basting action? Are you getting?
I'm not.
Okay, just a good.
Listen,
sear.
We keep it simple, Harry.
Okay, how about resting? Are you resting your steaks?
Depends on how many hungry mouths are staring at me.
That is always the case.
It is key. I know that. You know, learning how to cook. You know, basically on the grill, we tend to just vaporize the moisture right out of the damn steak. So slow cooking is a big deal. I do try to let it rest if we can, but you know, it just depends. Usually when we're making flat iron steak, it's usually with butter noodles.
Yeah, nice.
And I make a brown gravy. I'm basically making beef stroganoff.
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
But if I try to tell the kids we're having beef stroganoff, they're like, no. But if I put steak on noodles with brown gravy and a little sour cream, they're like, this is good. So
I can dig it. I can dig it. My I was recently hanging out with a friend. He's got a restaurant in Ohio, in Cleveland, and he's Ukrainian, and he has beef stroganoff on his menu. He's like, I have to call it something different now because of Russia and the issues. Like, he has, like, family in Ukraine and stuff. And he's like, we're not calling it beef stroganoff now. We're calling it something else. And I was laughing. I was
beef,
like,
it's gravy, noodles.
Yeah, something.
The dollop of sour cream.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of beef stroganoff. I don't know.
It's delicious, for sure.
Well, and, you know, we've come out of this weird, I mean, so many rules have been set now. It's hard. Like, chicken's a trippy thing to cook because we're so freaked out, right? Like, it's like going into a hazmat. You know, you just, I think I touched a chicken. I need to.
Right.
And someone told me that you can actually eat, not that we would want to do this, but you could actually eat raw wild chicken.
Yeah. So in Japan, they have chicken sashimi. That's probably the only place I'd eat raw chicken. I think that if it's all about the surface contamination in chicken a lot of times. So I think that if they blanch it on the outside, maybe. It's definitely what the chicken eats and how they live.
Well, and I think that's the transition that's happened. You know, we used to feed chicken.
Yeah, that's weird. Or like when chicken are sitting in their squat all the time and then where they're pecking at each other. And like, I think that the way chickens are battery raised, I mean, Delaware's the place that has more chicken than people. But if you know, and again, I'm not knocking any industries, people, it is what it is. But I think that's what causes the salmonella and the sickness. So it's like, right.
You can't feed chicken. We've learned this now. And now, you know, we feed them more wild food. But I think, you know, that started that. And now we're so freaked out on chicken. We'll overcook chicken to a point that it's just
so
not good.
They, you know, health code says 165, I think, for like 12 or 15 seconds.
Yeah.
When you cook a piece of chicken, if you cook it to 155, you know, 160,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
150 maybe, and then you tent it, let it rest so that it cooks up to the 165, people usually don't understand carryover cooking. It's like if you cook a piece of chicken in an oven that's 350 degrees, 375 degrees, and you're cooking it for an hour, you're putting so much hot energy, convecting air on this chicken, that when you put your thermometer in and you temp it at 165, by the time it's done carrying over cooking, it's going to get to 180, 190, and that's where you get that chicken that tastes like wood.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I always say if you touch it and it burns you, it's still cooking.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure. For minutes afterwards.
Right. Like exactly.
A time. Yeah.
Well, and you know, now, like if you cut open, you know, if you cook a piece of chicken to 165 and cut it open, especially like if you do like a rotisserie chicken or a full bird, you will cut through parts of that chicken that has red in it.
Yeah.
And people are like, what is that? It's like, it was 165. I know it's up to temperature. We're good.
For sure. So around the bones, when the chicken is butchered, you know, when it's dispatched, unalived.
Dispatched.
When a chicken is unalived, they bleed the chicken out.
Yeah.
Okay. So what you're seeing is you're seeing protein saturated water. You look at that red part in your brain automatically, like, oh, look at all that blood. But it's not really blood. It's water that has proteins in it that are, you know, people think of chicken as like boneless, skinless in styrofoam. But they don't remember that chicken was alive. It's a living thing. It's going to have bones. It's going to have, you know, it's like free range chicken. If you know, it's not everybody's in everybody's budget, but if you can eat a chicken that was really taken care of, that like got to go outside, got to stretch its chicken legs, eat some bugs and grubs, eat some, you know, chickens are like humans. They need a diverse diet. They need vegetation and protein and carbs. And like you get the sunlight and stretch it out. I mean, as a chef, I can totally tell the difference between really, really well taken care of, you know, chicken and then just boneless, skinless. But
well, and you can also tell by the size. I mean, we've become, you know, in the last 20 years, we've become very, I hate to use the word gluttonous, but we do like a big portion of chicken. And, you know, the reason you don't eat free range chickens is they're small. They're like little guys. And
yeah, it just depends. It depends on who is raising it and where it's coming from. And yeah.
I wonder if you could even hunt chicken.
I don't think there's enough wild chicken these days. I don't know. I think it was a domesticated kind of thing. I mean, not to say some haven't gotten out and you'll see them running down Route 24 at sometimes. But
it's chicken season.
If you ever pass Holly Lakes on 24?
Yeah.
They got some chickens that fly over that fence and just run down the road.
Yeah.
Well, and when I grew up in Albuquerque, and I used to go help out on this farm, and there were wild chickens, and they flew. I mean, they would fly away. I mean, you know, they didn't stay. They flew away. And
it was like a jump flight.
I don't know.
Do they maintain it?
Running a start.
And I don't think they're I don't think they're flying, you know, across states.
Like 20 yards at a time, maybe?
I think sort of like a turkey.
Do they have to worry about for coyotes out there or some other things? Yeah, I bet there's all kinds
of
predators.
You mean like the roadrunner and coyote?
Yeah, I think it's,
the state bird in New Mexico is the roadrunner.
There's predators out there that are going to get those shit. Yeah.
A fox killed all our chickens. My aunt had chickens and killed all the chickens we had except for the one kind of chicken that could fly up into the tree. And we came out, and those ones came out of the tree. They were the only ones left. So
I saw a thing on Instagram, and it showed this fox get into the hen or get into the pen, and was trying to get this chicken. And this freaking sheep came running over and like headbutted the fox and saved the chicken.
Really?
Yeah, it was like
that's awesome.
I wish we could figure out what animals say.
That's a children's book right there.
I think
fox
read
is
that
coming.
One.
Yeah.
That.
Run! Yeah, that's. I don't know. It's interesting. I think the more people are cooking. I think that's one of the cool things, a byproduct of a lot of cooking shows, is people are attempting to cook more. And I mean, that's a good thing, right?
Definitely. Yeah. I think people need to just, you know, not just shove food in their gullet. They need to care about it a little bit, you know, for your health or for eating for enjoyment or whatever reasons you find. You know, everybody has that meal where they're just rushing through. They just... Everybody has that easy meal, low-hanging fruit.
You know what's opened up cooking a little bit for me, and I know this might sound weird, but is the Instapot.
Oh, Instapots are great.
And you mentioned that short rib. I've watched a great show about this guy cooking. He made a short rib ragu in an Instapot, and he basically seared them off in the Instapot and then deglazed the pan, right? Deglaze, that's a word.
I think the term air fryer is really funny.
I haven't had any success with an air fryer yet.
I've seen people make some really, really great things out of it. You're not really frying anything. You know, frying is like a dry process where you're cooking something in oil. It's kind of a marketing term, but it's fast, hot convection roasting. I think I've seen recipes. I'm not a big air fryer cooker. You know, we have like a nice... tabletop oven that does some different things and stuff. But, the Instapot's awesome. I think that like opening up pressure cooking for people is a good thing. I think most people are intimidated by the old, like,
you don't want to see the lid blow a hole through your ceiling.
For sure. But to cook under pressure is amazing. Like you can get cuts of meat that are tough done very quickly. There's a lot of things like beets. Like you can cook a beet in like 40 minutes and it's like, perfect, you know, or like rice in 10 minutes.
Yeah. Well, I make biggest thing I cook in the Instapot is potatoes.
Yeah.
Like last night we had pork chops, potatoes, or red potatoes, and green beans. And I just put the red potatoes in the Instapot, hit pressure cook, and 25 minutes later, they're perfect.
That's awesome. That's a great recipe. Yeah. I have a recipe where I take starchy potatoes, okay, and I'll peel them.
So starchy, what would that be more?
So there's two different types of potatoes. There's waxy potatoes.
Like a Yukon Gold.
Yukon Golds are more waxy. Redskin potatoes are more waxy. Starchies are like Idaho potato.
Okay.
So I take an Idaho potato, and it doesn't have to be from Idaho, but you know what I'm saying. And
the big russet.
You got it. A russet potato.
There you go, buddy.
Beautiful, yes. So I peel the potato, and then I keep all the peelings, and I put them in the bottom of the Instapot, okay?
Oh.
And I put a little bit of water in there, and that's going to give more flavor and kind of nutrition to it. Then I pressure cook the potatoes, and then I rice them really quickly, like putting them through a ricer, like a food mill. And then I make gnocchi, okay? But a very, very quick gnocchi. But then what I'll mix with them is I'll just mix a little bit of cornstarch. I won't even add any eggs. I'll add some salt, and then I'll let those chill down. Once they're formed into the little dumpling shapes. And what happens is the cornstarch just totally binds the potatoes. It doesn't need any egg or any gluten. And then you can just cook the gnocchi and sauce them however you're going to sauce them. It's beautiful. It's so simple and it happens a lot faster. You know, it's like the big thing is like if you're making gnocchi traditionally, you're going to roast them in the skins and you have to really hurry up and rice them really quickly on flour so that all the moisture comes out. Where when you're cooking them in the Instapot, it only takes 20 minutes. It's really fast, and you can just pull the recipe together really quickly.
So what do you do with the skins? Do they just, are they there for just the flavor. Cooking on, but do you rice those skins too?
No, I don't. The skins are really just there to add flavor to the pot, add a layer of moisture, a barrier.
But then you
to
get
the
rid of them.
Then you get rid of them.
Yeah.
You could turn them into something. I mean.
Yeah, well, that's where, I mean, so I've been told that's where, all, at least is what I tell my kids, that's where all the vitamins are.
Yeah, when I love, you know, something I love is like when you do roast the potatoes and you scoop out the insides, frying those potato skins, the little bits of potato that's on the bottom, that's like the best part.
Twice fried?
Yeah, there you go. Fried and stuffed. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, those are delicious. Those.
Oh, for sure.
I'm a big fan. So let's talk a little bit more about the menu over at Grandpa Max, because I want, you know, I think there's a lot of people just think there's just macaroni and cheese there.
Yeah, we're not a Macintosh store. We don't sell computers there. It's mac and cheese. The menu is great. We have you walk in, there's a pasta maker, that extruder that makes 90 pounds of fresh pasta an hour. So we make all of the pasta fresh. You can pick between one of our 13 signature pasta dishes, or you can say, no, I'm going to do it my way. I'll take this pasta, this sauce. We have lots of different sauce options. We have pesto. We have an Alfredo sauce that's more similar to a cacio e pepe, like Parmesan and black pepper. It's not just all heavy cream. We do roasted garlic oil. We actually do a dairy-free vegan mac and cheese sauce, which is like pureed cauliflower and nutritional yeast flakes and a little bit of turmeric, carrots. That's a really good one. We do a mushroom ragu, a pork ragu. So if you're into pasta, we're the place, you know. Or you could just buy a pound of pasta and take it home.
But you mentioned a panini sandwich. You're doing others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So pasta is definitely our main seller,
yeah,
for sure. But yeah, we have soups, salads, panini sandwiches. So the panini sandwiches are great because you can also make those any way you want. You can add any cheese, add bacon. There's a mac and cheese one. There's the mushroom panini with goat cheese.
It's and like, panini is just that pressed kind of.
Yeah, so pan is bread and ini is small. So it's a pressed bread sandwich in Italian, which is where the word. And yeah, it's on the panini press. And when we press them on the panini press, there's like aluminum foil on the top and bottom. So it's like very contained, but it's beautiful heat from the bottom and top. So it gets the outside nice and toasty and crispy without being greasy. The inside's beautiful melting textures.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
A Cuban, that's kind of a panini, right?
It is. It is.
That's a delicious sandwich, the Cuban.
Oh, yeah. All the pork on it.
Well, it's all squeezed down. You don't know what's blending into what, and it's just awesome.
A beautiful marriage, for sure.
It's a beautiful marriage.
Yeah,
it's nice. What do you see in the future? You still more Grandpa Max? What's you got any more restaurants?
So right now I'm actually doing a teaching series where I'm teaching around the country. My next class will be in Orlando, Florida. It'll be a pasta class. I was just in San Antonio and in Austin teaching fermentation. That was really great. Soon I'll be going to the National Restaurant Association trade show, the NRA show in Chicago,
cool,
where I'm working with different equipment companies. And like, I have this piece of equipment. It's in my home kitchen or in my garage studio kitchen, where it is a vacuum sealer, but it's so much more than a vacuum sealer. It actually like pulls vacuums and infuses liquids the different, you know, alcohol's a great solvent. So you can take any flavor and look at the computer and push the button on the program, and it will make perfect essences and extracts of flavor. So I'm doing some really cool and interesting things with that. So my consulting business is really great, and it's like not even like I advertise it, but I'm always busy doing so many, you know, writing, helping people write menus, working on cocktail menus. One of the people I work for is called Think Rice. They're advocacy group based out of DC, Alexandria, and they advocate for all of the rice growers in the country. And they send me rice samples all the time that I kind of test and review, sometimes write recipes, help kind of think about marketing things. And they're really great. I actually got to go to the Mississippi Delta and drive one of those big rice harvesters, which was awesome.
Oh, wow.
And meet the people growing the rice. People don't think of rice as an American ag staple, but 85% of the rice eaten in America is grown in America. Arkansas is the biggest grower of rice, but then it's like California, Texas. Wow. I mean, rice is grown in a lot. I mean, I love rice. Are you a rice eater?
I love rice.
There's so many different styles of rice and so many different dishes you can do. Very versatile.
Well, and my favorite rice is like the you know, that has the brown rice, and it's the hardest freaking rice to cook, though.
Yeah, so yeah, maybe
it's like the best damn rice, but I always mess it up.
The brown rice takes a little longer. The wild rice takes a little longer.
I like wild rice.
Yeah, so I think the pressure cooker would be good for that. Maybe look up some Instapot recipes. Yeah. Because I think that that's the kind of perfect thing that will. Sorry, I'm sorry for somewhere. Yep.
No, I'm. You know what else I've been watching a lot of it? Back to YouTube University, but there's a lot of families now, and I don't know if it's from the pandemic, but that have gone out into nature, right? And basically decided they're going to provide all of their own food. And they garden, and they have chickens, and they, you know, constantly move in the chicken houses.
That's a full-time job. I really admire people.
It is a full-time job.
Yeah, and it's homesteading.
Yeah, if you think you're going to, like, cut corners and, like, get out of doing work by staying being a stay-home mom or dad and garden, and but it's more work than going to work. Because the lady that I follow who is so passionate about it She grows everything.
Pickles and cans.
Oh, she cans everything, and she freeze dries meat.
Yeah. Oh, a freeze dryer. Freeze dry people, if you're listening, I need a sponsorship. No, there's a freeze dryer called Harvest Right, and they're, you know, I'm plugging their product. I don't know if I can say that, but it's one that it's a home freeze dryer, and like I really want a freeze dryer because I want to take just things like when you freeze dry something. Like from a chef standpoint, you're getting it in its perfect form.
Yeah.
You know, you're taking out the moisture, but you're preserving all of the essential oils, all the flavor and aromatics. Like I want to get a freeze dryer just so I can freeze dry things so that I can crush the things that I freeze dry and add them to other recipes so I can add just pure flavor in.
Like, well, and they freeze dried beef. Yeah. They cooked beef like almost like into a taco style consistency and then laid it out on these pans and froze it. Or freeze dried it, and it came out as these little, meat almost nuggets. like the Dippin' Dots. Almost, it's almost like space meat. And the guy's like, I don't know about this. And then they packed it, and then they went and rehydrated it, and it was exactly like the meat. And it's great for like spaghettis,
chili. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, chilies.
I was like, just add water, and you get this perfect. Yeah, I wish I had some of those because I would add them to my ramen noodle at home.
Yeah,
you know, or like whatever.
But it was very cool, and I think as a person just watching, like, I'm not eating that. But you know, realizing that it actually plays a great role. They do it for storage,
right?
You know, it's.
Unfortunately, freeze drying technology like this has actually made it like that company has made it attainable, but obtainable still means you're spending $2,500 or like a freeze dryer is an investment. Before that, there were only lab freeze dryers, which are like $20,000, $40,000, $75,000.
Yeah.
I'm a technology nerd in those ways where I like to see one of the companies that I'm working with makes blast chillers. And we don't really think about blast chillers as much. This company's called Irinox. They're like the leading blast chillers. And we actually, with a person I work with named Maxwell McKinney, he is like represents these beautiful pieces of machinery. There's one in the Lewis School here.
Oh, wow.
And part of when you purchased it is training. So I got to go in and meet the lunch ladies. They're super sweet and nice. The school is beautiful. It's a new school. And it really makes sense for them. They can thaw things not under running water. Very, very, like it keeps all of the data in the computer. They can cook things and make them into the food safety zone really quickly.
Wow.
And then for this thing, they can actually like, they could cook their egg sandwiches. Okay. Keep them perfectly to the food safe temperature. And then when they come in the next day, set up a program and this blast chiller actually reheats it to the perfect temperature. So things are ready to serve as well. So there's a lot of efficiencies that can be created. In this country, there's not as many people that use them. In Europe, everybody uses them. It's a standard thing to do. And it's really safe. Like food safety is, you know, if you're letting things hang out in the temperature danger zone for too long, things can get dicey, you know, but like it's like 4 hours you're supposed to get things under 41 degrees and you're supposed to stage it down, you know. So, yeah,
I enjoy one of the things I like watching is these kind of these big kitchens. Like one of the ones I watch is these kitchens in Korea, mm-hmm. and feeding the kids. And the food that they feed these kids is amazing. And I want to
eat that food.
I want to eat that food. I mean, it is. I mean, I can't. I'm not going to embarrass myself to try to tell you the things that they're cooking, but it's just all fresh. And the amount of work that goes into each of these kids' dishes.
Oh.
But they're eating like kings. But I think, you know, how you mentioned this, you know, worried about food safety. So I think, and I'm sort of talking out of my ass a little bit, but it feels like we've gone to this place where everything is just super safe. Like there's not a lot of.
Yeah, you know, when I was in Thailand walking around, I definitely ate some things that were definitely in questionable temperature zones. And like I was there for a prolonged period. I got sick one time, and it wasn't because of the grilled meats on a stick that I was eating. It was from the dipping sauce from the water.
Yeah.
I think that food safety is important. I think that we really need to keep people safe, and the regulations are there. You know, again, when you're at your home, you know, keeping people safe is really important. So I think that things are over-regulated, but is it a good thing? Probably. I think people aren't getting as sick. I think people aren't getting as sick at restaurants, for sure. I think people, they say most people get sick from their leftovers or from things that they're cooking at home that have hung out too long, more so than in restaurants. Because I think that, like, everybody at a restaurant, all of our employees have gone through food safety training. And, like, you need to know the basics of, you know, like, cooking things to the proper temperatures, cooling things properly, proper sanitation. Mm. I think those things are important.
But, oh, absolutely.
But I think that, yeah, in this country, we definitely live in that nanny state. You know, if sometimes I have a 2-year-old, if he drops something on the ground and picks it up and eats it, I'm not just being like, spit that out right now. I think germs are a good thing. I think we over-sanitize things. Like when he's playing in the dirt, I think that gut biome, you know, like of the things, the bacteria, like we're filled with bacteria. We're filled with all kinds of different things. And like, I think those natural, I think the natural, the
germs immunity. Around
us. Yeah, exactly.
We've heard that lately, right? Yeah. Well,
it's a fully,
you know,
formed immune system is what you get.
I mean, back for in sure. the day, I mean, they used to make kids suck their thumb. That's how they got germs. That's how they, you know, got little doses of bad things. And that's what built up our immunity. There was, you know, we've gotten away from that. I know that, yeah, we won't make this about COVID, but we've just learned a lot about that kind of stuff last couple of years.
Like, I exactly what he was saying, though, I was thinking about, it's not exactly tied into food, but, like, I grew up playing in a creek. Yeah. And, like, you would find the little pools of, like, animal waste and, like, dance around them, but keep going and act like you haven't touched any of that.
Right.
And I just feel like looking back on that, I would not do that today, but it was probably a good thing to do as a child.
Well, they say, you know, because we went up to Connecticut, and my son and I went for a run, and we found this stream, and I'm like, oh, let's drink from it. Oh, it's so good. And my father-in-law's like, yeah, I don't know if you want to be doing that. But, I mean, what the hell? Yeah. It's like, it's water.
Yeah, I think that every...
Beaver fever.
Yeah.
I think there's so many, you know, I have one son that always wants to be outside, and one son that, like, really loves reading and loves gaming and all those things. And, like, I think it's, like, where we are, you know... Max will go, you know, play soccer, goes out and does the things as well. But I think that, like, being outside, stretching, you know, getting into good trouble isn't a bad thing. I think that it is – I think it's really good to explore. I think those are the things that – you know, being out in a creek, yeah, we were getting knee-deep in mud and, you know, running around. It's good for you.
Dude,
yeah.
We grew up swimming in golf course ponds.
Yeah. It's a little gross, yeah. But it
golf
makes courses, you stronger.
That's kind of sketchy.
Yeah.
Because all the there's takes a lot of chemicals to make those.
I was yeah, in the golf course industry.
To make
the greens
as green as they are.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I do a lot of foraging, you know, going out in the wild and, like, looking for mushrooms and wild ingredients to eat, you know, stinging nettles and all these things. And, yeah, it always sketches me out, like, when it's too, you know, some of the streams, waterways aren't as clean, or when it's too close to the road with, like, emissions, like, mm-hmm. like all of the exhaust we're putting in and all the heavy metals and stuff. Yeah. But yeah, I really like wild edibles. Like, as a little kid, it was always something I explored. One time I was
Do you know Nathan?
Nathan Tanner?
Yeah.
Nathan Tanner is
He's a foraging man.
Yeah, he's the man. Shout out to Nathan Tanner.
What's up, Nathan?
I used to have a drink on my menu called the Nathan Tanner at a Muse.
Yeah.
There's one, we used some sassafras for it, and he used to get all the sassafras roots and some of the leaves.
So people that don't know, Nathan is a forager. And he forages for restaurants.
Yeah.
I don't know how many. Maybe it was just one. I don't know, but he is into it. And I was like, I want to go forage with you.
He's such a smart person. Whenever you're foraging, you really need to know what you're doing.
Right.
And like, there are certain things that I just, little brown mushrooms are things that you don't mess with because there's so many different types. But it's like, I really love spore printing, but he knows all of the Latin names for things, and he does carpentry work.
Yep.
But he has science background and has always exploring, and he has such natural, like when you're foraging, like my favorite thing to forage is morel mushrooms. Okay.
Yeah.
They are so hard to find because they're like the perfect camouflage, and they're like pushing up under these leaves. And what you have to do is you have to know the trees and follow the trees around and look at where the trees root out. But then you really have to train your eyes to spot things. And like, even when I was riding in the car with him, when I'm talking on the phone, he's like, yeah, I just spotted this huge chicken of the wood mushroom 2 miles away up in a tree. And I'm like, to be able to spot that, to have that type of vision, it's cool. It's a gift for sure.
Well, I'm a big nature guy and love running, and I love just every day you go into, I run the Breakwater Trail, but it's, it's a trail through the woods more or less.
Yeah.
And, one day we'll have different mushrooms growing, and it's just a whole thing.
For sure.
It goes on out there.
I think that's the best type. For me, for so long, it was like four walls in a kitchen getting it done. Where when I was out looking for wild ingredients, it's just like a peaceful walk where you're like in the zone, you're smelling different things, you're smelling some onion, you're feeling breezes, you're like aware of everything around, like running, walking. I think we're blessed to have such beauty in this area. Cape Henlopen has always been my special place, sacred place.
Oh, yeah.
As a little kid hanging out and walking around on the trails, and it's beautiful.
Well, I love the beach. But, my daughter and I, we went for a bike ride on the I happen to live right next to the Junction Breakwater Trail. So we ride and run to it all the time. And I posted a clip of her riding her bike through. It's just magnificent. It almost looks like Japan. I don't even know. But it's just so beautiful. And I say, I love the beach, but I'd take this all day.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Awesome stuff.
Yeah. We have beautiful parts of Delaware.
Yeah. Well, listen, man, I appreciate it. I don't know how long we've been talking, but
it's a good one.
That was a good one.
Entertaining, though.
Yeah, no, listen, I appreciate it. Yeah, and I love promoting chefs. I love promoting restaurants.
I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy to be, again, in the community of chefs, of the beach area is growing all the time, and just so happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me on. Oh, great conversation. Great hanging with you.
Well, and we're in a blessed area, right? I mean, you go in 400 miles into the middle of the United States, and you probably won't have the amount of restaurants and the amount of small businesses that are going on. We're a little protected here by that sweet ocean to our left, but we have to remind ourselves how lucky we are that we have what we have here, because I don't know how many restaurants we have in this town. 50?
A lot.
Yeah.
More than that.
Yeah. And you're not going to find that everywhere. So I'm glad that we all kind of stick together and promote one another.
For sure. And not only 50 restaurants, but we have chain restaurants, but we have a community of people that are hospitality people that really care, people that are serving people that are being creative, cooking delicious food. And it is something that is been in this area for a long time. I have a good friend. His name is Keith Fitzgerald. Mm. He owned the Back Porch for many, many years. And, he was cooking creative, awesome food for people before it was a thing, And like, I think that there's been, the Blue Moon for so many years. I think there's like restaurants in Rehoboth that have been around and stood the test of time and like really made precedent for all of the other great restaurants in the area. And now it's like, there's great restaurants in Long Neck. There's great restaurants in Milford. Yeah. There's great restaurants in, you can go to any town in Delaware, not just at the beach, and really have a good quality food experience. And that's a great thing.
We talked about this a little bit, not us, but in a different podcast that, I've been here since 94. I mean, we've watched this town change, and, people are coming in, and Want to get that local sticker. But, you know, I said for me at least.
How do I get one? How do I get a local sticker?
We've been here too long. No. but, you know, it's about the ups and downs. It's the ebbs and flows of this town. And, you know, we've had years where are amazing and we've had years where a lot of change has taken place. And, you know, we don't complain about the change. We welcome it. And, you know, we've watched this. Basically, Rehoboth's been almost the heartbeat of this area. And we're starting to see Millsboro and Milton and Long Neck and a lot of great areas. We just had Ada's Kitchen on yesterday. She was amazing. They're making amazing food down there.
Where's that restaurant?
It's on Long Neck Road. It's called Ada's Kitchen.
Awesome. Ada's Picnic.
Ada's Picnic. I'm sorry. Fuck.
It's right across from the Grottos in the old Capriotti's building. Okay. If you know where that was.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. They're making all fresh food over there. And awesome. Yeah, it's just
simple, but made with
my
love.
My mentor, my good friend is in the Brickworks in Long Neck right now. His name's Kevin Reading. And
Kevin, he had, what was the place in Milford?
So he had Abbott's there.
Yeah, Abbott's. That's where I knew him from.
A long time ago, he had a restaurant in downtown Rehoboth, which was just so good. It was like my favorite place to go eat. It was called Espuma. He cooked Mediterranean food there. And then when he opened up Naj, I definitely went there with him. And it was the rest is history. But yeah.
He's a hustler.
Oh, he's the most athletically talented person I've ever met. Like, he is like, he can pick up a thing and just do it. You know, my little brother's like that. Orion's like, shout out to Orion as well. My little brother can, you know, like somebody was like, oh yeah, your brother would just play. Oh, he's playing tennis with Billy Lucas. And he was like, oh, your brother Orion's a hustler. Like he was playing tennis. Or like my little brother won't play golf for a while and just start stroking it. You know, he's a natural athlete, plays soccer.
I tried to get him on here with us and he was like,
he'll come on. After he listens to this, he'll be here.
Well, we've put in the time and we're starting to see the fruits of it. And you know, we're very blessed. So
yeah,
thank you.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here and happy to be here with the growth of the area. And
yep.
Great conversation.
Come and join us another time.
Cheers. I'll be back.
All right, brother. Thank you, man.